Northwest one. Get your ticket on the Central Line. Get off at Bond Street and step into the limelight. There's two just waiting for you, waiting for you to make it soon. Well, I really do, I wish you well. Yes, I wish you well.
The period of time at WNAW-FM from 1967 until I left in 1976, I moved to California to do some of my writing work. I'm a novelist. I have three books published by Random House and Doubleday, two by Doubleday, one by Random House. And I was working on one and had a little money in my pocket, and I wasn't married at the time. And I didn't owe any money to anyone, and I had no children, and it seemed the right time to do it if I was serious about it. And I was aware that changes were imminent, that consultants were being hired, that music illiterate program directors were offering opinions. And that hadn't happened in all this period of time, because it was assumed that whoever was on the air knew his or her music. And of course we did, because we had started with it. We knew it inside and out, and I certainly knew it because I listened to every track of every album, practically every album, just to make sure there wasn't a hidden jewel on band five, side two, as frequently there was for some reason. So I also saw that when you hire a consultant in radio, it's basically a kamikaze maneuver. In my judgment, the radio consultant is the lowest form of making a living in the United States today. And the men who populate the arena are intellectually disgusting to me. Because they are dispensing advice, and it's like trying to teach French when you don't speak any French yourself and don't know the history of the country, have never been to Europe, and you live in Philadelphia, and yet you are authoring advice on the language and on the morals of Europe and France, and on the manners and the conduct, and being paid to do it. And you are attempting to teach what you don't know to men and women who've grown up in France and who are fluent in the language. And that's the analogy I can draw, and have. So there, you have an analogy on a piece of tape. My decision to leave in 1976, move out to California and leave radio, happily, that I made the decision and left before these consultants whooshed onto the scene like a massive oil spill, and I was never subjected to them at WNAW-FM. I know that Allison stayed on, and was brutally treated by subsequent managements and consultants at WNEW-FM. But Pete Fornatel recently experienced the very same consultants at a station that he was working at here in New York, experienced unpleasantly their illiteracy. When I came back to New York, 300 pages later, a novel called Distant Stations, I resumed my Sunday show on WNEW AM as if it had never stopped, and eventually became a citizen of AM, but taking with me the very best of FM, the lack of self-aggrandizement on the air, in terms of a station display of how great the station was, jingles, and this is the top, you're listening to the best, the highlight, the great, you just, the radio lie that makes much of it so vulgar and dreadful. And people speaking in unnatural voices. Have you ever heard a guy who speaks like this? In real life, would you pass the salt, my darling? Well, I've always felt that you should be on the radio what you are off the radio, for better or worse. Bring yourself, in all honesty, to the radio. And that's the advice I would certainly give to anyone attempting to speak on the radio. Be who you are. And if that's not good enough or sufficient enough or it's not what that particular management is looking for, you'll find someone who says, hey, that's fine if you work hard enough and look hard enough. But the consultants I mentioned earlier have in their own mind their own speaking voice, and many of them were disc jockeys. That, of course, is what's happened to radio now. And there are all too few of us left who simply say, hello, this is a record I think you'll like. And at the end of the record, saying, I hope you like that record, and here's another one. I've always liked this record because in 1957, Sinatra made this record of this Rodgers and Hart song with a particularly good Nelson Riddle arrangement. Let's see what you think. Here's Sinatra and I Wish I Were in Love Again. And clearly, Pete Fornatel was one of the people who, you speak to Pete, that's who he was on the radio, precisely. Scott Muni is a fellow who begins sentences in the middle of the sentence, on and off the air. I always used to kid him and say that his program was a program that began in the middle for the benefit of the people who came in the middle. So that I and others, it takes a little while in listening to Scott to divine what it is he's saying. And once you get it, then you're captivated by just that wonderful male sound that Scott makes on the air and off. The point is, however, that he begins in the middle, both on and off the air. There's no difference whatsoever. I feel that, by way of conclusion, that there's a cultural meltdown, if I can put it that way, that is so demoralizing going on, not only in music, but in popular art, in serious art, that has been created by the demoralization of thought, it seems to me, and the slothfulness of craft and the lack of it, and technology, and at the moment we're in trouble, I think, as a community. It's not only the United States of America; it's all over the world, and it's just like a cultural meltdown. In those days, at the beginning of WNEW-FM in the late '60s and early '70s, we were blessed with some of the best music of the century. It was a fluke of nature, like Ron Guidry in 78 for the Yankees. I mean, Bob Dylan himself is a fluke of nature. But the combined effort, the outpouring, every few days, there was an extraordinary album by Joni Mitchell out of Canada, or Crosby, Stills, Nash, and then, of course, Neil Young joined them subsequently. By somebody, an album or albums that are listened to this day.
This is 90.7 FM and WFUV.org, member-supported WFUV New York, public radio from Fordham University.
Pete Fornatel is our guest on another unconventional Sunday morning. And Pete, back in the early days of WNEW-FM and the early days of the music, how did the music influence you, and what was it like to be a part of all of those records that were just coming in by the boatloads that were just fabulous and unprecedented?
Well, that process obviously had begun for me at Fordham and at FUV. I told you that I was there from 63 to 67. When you start looking at the way that music changed in those years, when you start looking at how the album became the main form of communication, when you think about the British invasion and how America had to sort of reclaim rock and roll, which originated here, of course, and did so in the hands of some very creative, talented, and innovative musicians. I always point to that very fertile period, which I call America's response to the British invasion, and it took many forms. There was, of course, soul music, as represented by the Otis Reddings and the Aretha Franklins of the world. Motown had been around a while, but really obviously became a powerhouse in the mid-60s. The Beach Boys made the leap from surf girls, dance cars, to a very adult approach to rock music with the Pet Sounds album, which, by the way, is 30 years old this month, May of 1966. I still consider that one of the top three of all time. And perhaps the biggest creative leap was taken in the area of folk rock. You know, that combination of folk music with electricity was irresistible. Dylan, of course, leading the way, making the switch from a purely acoustic framework to rock and roll in 1965 with Like a Rolling Stone. One of the things I like to think about these days is that a major artist releases an album, maybe one album every 3 or 4 years, your Billy Joels or your Bruce Springsteens. Back then, you know, because it was a different time, because the demands of the marketplace were different, your major groups had contracts requiring 2 or 3 albums in a calendar year. And that's how you could come up with the output that the Beatles had right around the time of, say, Rubber Soul and Revolver, or the Beach Boys, who were putting out 2 or 3 a year. And Bob Dylan, in 1965, both Bringing It All Back Home and Highway 61 were revisited. It was revisited. Highway 61 Revisited came out, both in the course of 1 year. These were recordings that were just changing the nature of the way that people listened to music, the way that they looked at the world. And it was just a phenomenally exciting time to becoming involved in rock and roll and in radio. So I had that whole framework happening at Fordham. 67, of course, is Sgt. Pepper. Again, another one of those top three. I put that right up there with Pet Sounds. The birth of WNEW-FM in 67. 68, another great year for rock and roll. Beggar's Banquet by the Stones, the White Album by the Beatles. And now it's 1969 as I'm arriving at the station. And what's going on in music? Tommy by The Who had come out in May of that year. The debut album by Crosby, Stills, and Nash had literally been released that summer. The debut album by one of my favorite bands, Poco, had come out that summer as well. So I arrived at WNEW-FM to find just this remarkable library of albums from the immediately preceding few years, plus all that came in 69 and on into the 70s. So there was never any dearth of material to play on the radio for people. The record cabinets were well stocked, shall we say.
Welcome back to another unconventional Sunday morning. Pete Fornatel is our guest. And Pete, when was the, or where was the point, or when was the point when you knew that those days were coming to a close?
Would it be too specific for you if I said the spring of 1979? an ARB ratings book came out that ratings period, which showed that WKTU, a disco station, had become number one in the New York market with double numbers, with a share in the double numbers, numbers that hadn't been seen since the heyday of WABC in New York. That virtually put the nail in the coffin of whatever you want to call it, free-form, progressive, experimental FM, because things became too business-oriented. FM was no longer the bastard stepchild of radio. It had not only achieved parity with AM, but it had, in fact, surpassed it. That meant there was money to be made. That meant the corporations began paying attention and getting involved in a way that they never had before. And, of course, along with that came homogenization and, no risk-taking format, for that matter. I mean, I was so spoiled by my experiences at Fordham and by my first 10 years at WNEW-FM that the mere idea of interference with the programming of my show was really, really horrible to me. And that's when it all began, actually, in the aftermath of KTU's success. it was so frustrating and so depressing after all of those years of not being able to distinguish between what was my job and what was my life. All of a sudden, it became very apparent to me what was my job and what was my life. And I'd get off the air at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, come home to my house on Long Island, and go to sleep. You know, I mean, it was so depressing that I didn't want to deal with, and sleep was an escape. And it went on that way for a couple of years, you know. On the one hand, I had, at that point, these practical obligations like a family and a mortgage.
Food.
And a Yorkshire Terrier to keep in kibbles and bits, you know. On the other hand, I was no longer deriving the greatest satisfaction from my work, which, as I mentioned to you earlier, was programming the shows that I was doing on the radio. So it was quite a difficult period that really didn't resolve itself until 1982.
When?
Well, when things got even worse. At that point, you know, the rock umbrella used to cover and serve a number of different kinds of music. You know that this type of radio was built upon the Arlo Guthries and the Phil Oakses of the world. And in the early 80s, as radio became more and more compartmentalized, you know, suddenly you were specializing in rock and roll at the expense of these other kinds of music. And I remember one day someone actually came into the studio and we had our albums listed alphabetically by a group or artist, and they started picking through them, taking out the Judy Collinses and taking out the Gordon Lightfoots.
Oh boy.
And the Harry Chapins, and my heart sank. I mean, there was a time when Judy Collins and Led Zeppelin coexisted very nicely on the same radio station, and that's the kind of radio I liked then and still care about to this day. When I saw those albums leaving the room, I knew that I either had to find another way to make a living or come up with some sort of a solution that would satisfy my needs and tastes. And that solution for me was a Sunday morning program called Mixed Bag, done as close to the old style of FM as was allowable in the early to mid-80s. And there, too, I took a big leap of faith, you know, let me see when it was. I guess in 83, Mixed Bag had been on almost a year. The station was even getting more formatted and more structured, and I was getting unhappier and unhappier. And finally came to the point where I went to the current management at the time and said, look, you know, I would much rather concentrate my efforts on things like the Sunday Show and the Hungerthon and another program that was on the station called Saturday Morning 60s, which was, of course, an echo of what we used to do as well. And they gave me permission. I did that. I switched to weekends in 83, and that's where I remained until I left there in 1989 for K-Rock. So for 6 years, I pretty much was doing radio on my own terms, admittedly 2 days a week instead of full time, but nonetheless very satisfying. There was no guarantee that it was going to work, but both of those shows were wildly popular on the station. Mixed Bag won a couple of awards, got a lot of attention in the press. So for me, it was a happy ending.
World surround me from inside a phone booth, and it began to astound me. I tried to keep my cool. I said it must be Sunday. Everybody's telling the truth, and then they get it might be Monday.
Pete, the show Mixed Bag was one of the first shows that I guess had kind of felt that I had a renewed feeling that somebody out there actually still cared.
I appreciate that.
You know, and I would tune into that show religiously every Sunday, and I've often told people that I'd put my headphones on at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that house could burn down and anything could happen, but that was my 3 hours of therapy. And you know, I guess in reference to what you said before, switching over to the weekends, you probably got more, I know you got more fulfillment out of those 3 hours than you probably did, you know, working the whole, you know, week in that other environment. Tell me about what some of your memorable moments are from that show, of some of the people that you met and that you interviewed.
There's so many, Fred. There are so many.
I know.
It just was an opportunity once again to do the kind of radio that I believed in, and of course, live performance was a part of that. I always give credit to Roger McGuinn for the idea originally, because back in the McGuinn Clark Hillman days, he came up to the radio station with his acoustic 12-string and played some things on the air, and I said, gee, you know, this ought to be a regular part of some show that I do here, and obviously it became a part of Mixed Bag just about a year later. I always give credit to Richie Havens as kind of the spiritual father of Mixed Bag. He was the first artist ever played on WNAW-FM in 1967 from the Mixed Bag album, which is, of course, why we stole the name for our show at the time.
Right, and that was High Flying Bird, right?
High Flying Bird, that is correct. And then there were all of the opportunities to meet people that for one reason or another I hadn't gotten together with in my rock and roll life, and that included Pete Seeger. The morning I spent with him on the radio, well, there have been a couple since, but that first one is etched in my memory. My relationship with Crosby, Stills, and Nash had begun in the 70s, but it was solidified and cemented during the Mixed Bag run. Another one that always pulls at my heart is Steve Goodman. Steve was up about a year before his untimely demise, and when you listen back to it now with the wisdom of hindsight, it's just one of those moving episodes. A lot of people have told me that over the years. And I've concentrated on the more familiar established names, but I should also tell you another remarkable story, which is that after the first Mixed Bag show in December of 1982, that very week, I got a 2 or 3 page typewritten single space letter from a listener who went on to praise the show and the idea of the show, and said to me that there was a new acoustic music scene happening in Greenwich Village around a club called the Speakeasy, which put out their own records. They tried to make it monthly, but didn't always make it. And she included a couple of discs with her songs on them. And I don't know if you know where I'm heading with this, but the letter was signed Suzanne Vega. I began playing her records from the Speakeasy albums on the third week of Mixed Bag in 1983. And was privileged to play some role in getting her heard and ultimately signed to A&M Records, and you know the rest of the story.
Absolutely.
And she gives credit and tells that story to this day, so I couldn't be more pleased with having played a role in Suzanne's rise.
Even if I am in love with you, all this to say would stick to you. Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprints on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it later. Our man who watches from the wall, her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing, with the only
soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think I've called my destiny, but I am changing. Marlena on the wall.
Pete Fornatella is our guest on another unconventional Sunday morning. And one of the things that, to me, was always a highlight when I lived up in the New York area, Pete, was the weekend before Thanksgiving. And it was a wonderful, it was always such a wonderful, heartfelt time for everybody to kind of get together, the musicians that were there. And I'm speaking about the Hungerthon programs that you did from the United Nations. How did you get involved in that? And maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Two words. Harry Chapin. I knew Harry from before his performing days. He was a filmmaker at the time that we met. It's a very strange story, but a true one. I was emceeing a benefit for an injured fireman on Long Beach in 1970, I guess, fall of 70. And I left the benefit and was on my way back to Southern State Parkway on Long Island. And there was this lanky guy on the side of the road hitchhiking, and I picked him up, and it was Harry Chapin. I knew his brothers, Steve and Tom, were in a group called the Chapins, but Harry himself at that point wasn't performing. He was a filmmaker. And, you know, he knew me from the radio. I knew him from his brothers because he wrote the music for them at the time. And we just began a friendship that lasted until his untimely death in 81. He brought the Hungerthons to NEW in 1975, and I participated in the first three of those. And then after Harry's death, the organization that he formed, World Hunger Year, was experiencing hard times. And so together with Bill Ayers, we revived the idea of Hungerthon in 1985 as a fundraiser. And Harry left some big shoes to fill, but in the course of the 10 years, the event just grew from year to year to the point where last November we made $500,000 for World Hunger Year.
Wow.
So I'm obviously very proud of that work. And we were talking earlier about the highlights of my experiences on Mixed Bag. One of the sad things is that I never got the chance for Harry to be a guest on Mixed Bag. That it will always bother me that someone who really was the heart and soul of that show was not available, of course, for the in-studio visit at that time.
Did I write that? Christ, it sounds like the theme from Godfather 2. Okay. Listen,
if you count really extra fantastic, maybe we can get through that lame piece of music that starts this song, okay?
Did he start the song yet?
Okay, so just count with so much energy that it will get us through those next two bars. Are you ready? You gotta really blow the house down.
Harry, don't mess it up.
We watched our sweet
Welcome back to another Unconventional Sunday Morning. Pete Fornatel has been our guest on another Unconventional Sunday Morning. And, Pete, I just wanted to mention that coming up right after this segment, we're going to rebroadcast the tribute show that we did for Alison Steele back on the 1st of October of 1995. Can you give us some of your thoughts about Alison?
Well, Fred, you were kind enough to send me a copy of that show, and I did attempt to get word back to you how well I thought you served her memory. The Nightbird is a true legend of FM radio. As she told you herself, the entire story of the development of that persona. When I think back to what can now only be called the glory days of FM radio, I have to think of the major personalities that I was first awakened to on the FM dial. And, of course, that would include the gentleman Roscoe, whom I mentioned earlier, as well as Jonathan Schwartz, a truly unique radio performer. And, of course, high on that list as well, Alison Steele, the Nightbird. As sorry as I was about her death, I was glad to see that she received the attention that she deserved in all of the obituaries and stories and reports and outpourings that occurred after her death. Because there is no question about it, Alison Steele single-handedly opened the door for all of the women that followed her into rock and roll radio in this country over the course of the last 30 years.
Pete Fornatel has been our guest on another Unconventional Sunday Morning, and as I had mentioned at the beginning of this segment, the 5 years of this show is coming to its complete circle in 2 weeks on May 19th, 1996, and I have to say, Pete, that it is because of your influence and the influence of some of the other people, especially yours, that wanted me to carry on that sort of thing when I left New York in 1989 and came down here and realized that there was nothing like a mixed bag down here, and I felt like I needed to do something to change that. And in the past 5 years, we've done our best to try to open the eyes, and it was amazing, the thirst. It still is amazing to me, the thirst from the audience for the type of music that we play. And I want to thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart for doing all that you have done for me.
Well, Fred, that is greatly appreciated, and I can't tell you how happy I am to have been able to participate in this milestone. More to come.
Land with a guitar in my hand, and the night
90.7 WFUV closed many a show with that one. Run for Home by Lindisfarne. My thanks to Fred Migliori from another unconventional Sunday morning on WFIT in Brevard County, Florida, for the use of his 1996 interview with myself and Jonathan Schwartz about the beginnings of progressive rock FM radio. We will wrap up this audio biographical edition of Mixed Bag right after these words. Pete Fornital back with you on this audio biographical edition of Mixed Bag. My thanks to Eric Rastetter, Kevin Kaminsky, Frank Pavlak, Chip Cristarella, Don McGee, and especially Fred Migliori for making it all possible. As always, your comments and suggestions are welcome at mixedbagradio.com or mixedbag@wfuv.org. For all my fellow August 23rd birthday celebrants, let me offer these final musical words of wisdom at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at WFUV.org.
Schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life becomes exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive just by being alive. Here is the best part. You have a head start if you are amongst the very young. At heart,